Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. Very excitedly, coming to you from a makeshift studio that we've fashioned backstage after ATS Madrid's. And I want to welcome our very special guest this week, Dennis Buckheim from IAB Tech Lab. Dennis.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
No, we're very delighted to have you. And Dennis was obviously speaking at ATS Madrid earlier today, so he didn't come all the way from the US just for this, but we're very excited to have him. And of course, ExchangeWise Lindsay Rountree. How's it going there, Lindsay?
Really good. How are you?
Very good. Lindsay's doubling up as tech.
I'm the sound man today.
You are? Yeah. AV sound man.
Who knows how well that will go? We'll find out when we actually edit this afterwards.
Right. So let's get started with a bit of a discussion of this week's news stories. The first story I wanted to chat about with you guys was news announced a couple of days ago that LinkedIn are set to acquire Drawbridge, cross-device identity tool. So this sort of I'm interested to hear what both of you think about this. I suppose we were a little bit puzzled about it at ExchangeWire to some extent, just because it seems like an interesting acquisition. There seems perhaps some obvious reasons for it, but we know that Drawbridge pulled out of operations in the US post GDPR.
Europe.
What did I say? The US?
Yeah.
I meant Europe.
Similar, but different.
Guys, it's been a really long day.
It's been a really long day. So they pulled out of Europe post GDPR. So, and a lot of sort of interviews around that time focused on Drawbridge set to work out a sort of more privacy compliant solution within their tool anyway. So is this, we'll be interested to know whether LinkedIn, once they integrate Drawbridge, will be actually rolling that out to a European marketplace as well. And of course, you know, LinkedIn's position on this in their press release was this is adding to their suite of marketing tools, and we know that they're really ramping up their advertising efforts. So I'm going to throw over to you first, Dennis. What do you make of this acquisition by LinkedIn?
I think time will tell, to what degree it remains as an independent business, as part of the portfolio, as you said, of marketing solutions from LinkedIn, versus how much it's integrated into the core of their own business. Clearly, LinkedIn is a massively cross-device application,
Tool, application.
And so I think that's one of that could be a key motivator for why they felt this was an interesting acquisition. Also comes at a time when so much is changing on the identity landscape, identifier landscape, really, with cookies fading into the distance and all of that. So I think it's an interesting, the timing is interesting on that.
Yep.
And at the very least, they're picking up some very knowledgeable people, who have been working in a space that's of unquestionable value, to any large scale publisher.
Yeah, absolutely. What are your thoughts on this, Lindsay?
Well, first of all, how can you have a Drawbridge without a moat? I think people were hoping that Oracle would buy them just so they could actually have bought Drawbridge and Moat.
How long have you been saving that line? That's pretty good.
Yeah, a long time.
It does make it sort of sound like Lindsay's, this is what Lindsay does in her spare time, is work out how ad tech and martech solutions could go together.
I rarely get to use them, so it's a very exciting time for me.
Excellent jokes.
Yeah.
You're all warmed up from being on stage at ATS. I like it.
Exactly. I do think it's kind of interesting. I think the thing about LinkedIn, more so than any other social networking platform, if you look at LinkedIn as a social network, yes, it's a B2B social network, but it largely is that. It's much more varied in terms of device usage. So the likes of Facebook, Snap, Instagram, they're largely mobile-led, and a lot of the audience is mostly mobile-led. Whereas LinkedIn, people are using them on work devices, on home personal devices, on phones, on tablets. And so LinkedIn are really ramping up their marketing solutions, but they actually probably haven't got the cross-device piece nailed yet.
Yeah.
So an effort for them to be able to kind of tie those dots together, I think, Drawbridge as an acquisition does make sense if they can then understand their audience better in an effort to deliver better targeted and better measurable solutions to the marketers they're trying to work with.
Yeah. And I mean, I suppose further to Dennis's point, it'll be interesting to know how they will integrate this. You were, when we were talking in the prep for this, Lindsay, you mentioned, will they be using it across some of their new products like live TV?
Yeah.
And if so, what will that look like? And I guess, like I said, it's really interesting to know if they're going to be focusing, just exclusively on the US market, or if they are looking to acquire more global markets because, as we also mentioned in a couple of the, well, certainly in the introductory bit to ATS this morning, you know, we know LinkedIn are really aggressively growing their advertising business. So it feels as though, you know, this could be, like you say, something that was fortuitous timing, knowing what's kind of coming down the line and how they need to equip themselves.
And if you think about it to that point from the drawbridge perspective, right, and from drawbridge's exit from Europe, the, you know, the key to being successful in really not just Europe, but, you know, any country going forward that, that has privacy regulations or any region that has privacy regulations is having a direct-to-consumer relationship somewhere in the chain. Yep. So that you can reliably, you know, ensure that you're capturing the consent of the user to the extent that you need to, right, and propagating that accordingly. And so I think you could even argue that you know, drawbridge, if you thought about this as, you know, from, you know, the drawbridge CEO perspective, this is a good way for them to build that business because they suddenly would have a much stronger, you know, first party partner in LinkedIn
platform. Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And actually Alex Stranger made an interesting point because in the press release, they do talk about tech and team. And the fact that it was specific to sort of talking about tech and team, like Alex Stranger sort of think it could be an acquihire. Because it's so tough to get good people.
Yeah.
And actually with Drawbridge, do have some good people, and what would their future be otherwise? Actually, you've got some good people in the Drawbridge business. LinkedIn has struggled, they're trying to ramp up efforts. They've struggled to keep people in the past. So yeah. Actually maybe this could be a good opportunity for them to bring those people in.
Yeah. Yeah, we watch with interest to see how that one unfolds. Second story I wanted to chat with you guys about is the announcement last week that Apple are launching a new ad attribution tool, which is, you know, very tongue-tyingly titled Privacy Preserving Ad Click Attribution. Really not easy to say quickly. You know, it's partly in response to attribution concerns on the back of ITP updates in the Safari browser. It's clearly aimed at being able to attribute without an identifiable user or person involved in that scenario. They've outlined a couple of ways in which the tool will allegedly achieve this by limiting the number of campaign IDs, only measuring on the campaign on the site where the ad was clicked, and delaying ad click and conversion data. So I'm really interested to know what both of you think about the impact that this is going to have in general, also the impact that it's likely to have on existing attribution tools. Will they be able to be used in the Safari browser, or is this going to supersede those tools and block other tools out? How is it going to apply in a video context? And also, you know, since it's clearly focused, squarely focused on click attribution only, what does it mean for display in Safari? I mean, there's probably a lot of very big, important sub questions attached to that, but maybe let's just start with some initial views, beginning with you, Dennis.
So yeah, I think it's encouraging on the one hand, right, to see Apple apparently acknowledging that, okay, there are some use cases here, right, that are badly broken by Safari ITP that maybe need to be, you know, resurrected to a degree. I think that's, you know, that's useful for the industry. I think the flip side argument to that is that, you know, in some ways that's a kind of bottom up approach of rebuilding, you know, rebuilding the capabilities that were previously enabled by cookies. Right. And that's, it's understandable why that's all happening, but, you know, but there's a different approach to look at it from a top down perspective of, you know, how do we fix the overall problems that we have, that, you know, in some ways we have created in the industry, and, you know, maybe we do support moving away from cookies, and we support much more consumer consent and engagement. Certainly, I think is really critical. So, if you think about that top-down approach, you know, what does it take to really solve the overarching problems, rather than kind of building up use case by use case by use case, you know, from the bottom again, and doing so in a way from the, you know, in that bottom-up approach, doing so in a way that is likely to have its own flaws for sure. That is significantly, if it's not done at an industry-wide level, going to have all of these, you know, sort of silos and challenges of integration, and really understanding what's working and what's not, and being able to reach the right consumers and all the things that, you know, we've solved in various ways over 20 plus years. But, you know, I think that's, to me, that's the most interesting question is, you know, okay, so if Apple does this, what happens, you know, with Chrome Everything and what else. Happens with, you know, Firefox and all of these, right? And then what happens on mobile devices? Because, you know, we think that there's a good chance that device IDs or identifiers for advertising on mobile devices, at least in the iOS world, are at risk, right? So how much of this do we wind up having to rebuild, I think is a key question, and versus how much can we really step back and say, okay, with the right, you know, controls and participation across the industry, you know, we could actually come up with a better answer that is more flexible, that is more consistent across platforms, and that absolutely respects privacy, which I think we all at this point pretty clearly understand we need to do.
Yeah.
So that's sort of overarching thought, at least to begin with.
Yeah.
I guess it's these the standards conversation as well. Dennis, we spoke on stage earlier at AWS Madrid about standards and the importance of standards in a sort of transparent ecosystem. And actually, Apple launching this across Safari, and they are encouraging other browsers to do the same. They've submitted the protocol, if you like, to the World Wide Web Consortium and said, guys, we think you should all do the same as well. And Rachel, we spoke about Do Not Track recently on a podcast of Adam Ray and how well Do Not Track went when it was adopted by all the browsers, as in...
completely ineffective.
You could put through a do not track request, but they'll still track you anyway.
Yeah.
If it were picked up, how far would it be taken? I guess the point is, as Dennis said, it is to mitigate how far they've gone with ITP to be able to give you some level of tracking. But if you think about it from a kind of a buying perspective, it really does bring you back to old school buying days. And obviously, this is a click related product. So it's you know, sort of, you're looking at sort of the paid search and the kind of the real kind of targeted, almost acquisition-led display. It's no good for branding, but you can't get any information from it. And then maybe it's perfect for contextual targeting. Mm. But the fact that you would be able to run a campaign and then find out if within a 48-hour period that might have resulted in a conversion, it means that a lot of the kind of the basic targeting that you would have done in a display campaign or in any kind of campaign is largely out the window. I mean, it's out the window anyway with ITP. Mm. So I guess you're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
It's rebuilding, to a degree.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, and Dennis, you talked about rebuilding. Like, how far do we go before we actually are completely rebuilding the entire industry?
And I think that's really the key question is do we want to go down that path, right? Yeah, yes, we know we can do a lot of things better the second time around, but literally hitting reset and having to rebuild everything
is
crazy.
It doesn't make sense,
it doesn't,
right?
It really doesn't. I frequently have described the organic evolution of our industry and have said, and that's not in the good sense of organic, right? It's like,
there's been not healthy.
Yeah. That it's, you know, there has been tremendous innovation, obviously, over 20 to, 25 years now. And, probably some overshooting of where we should have gone, you know, to be candid. But that happened because people saw these opportunities and saw how they could fix problems that they spotted. Now we have an overly complex, not sufficiently friendly to consumers ecosystem. As we were saying, does it make sense to go all the way back to the Stone Ages? No. What can we learn? What can we hit, kind of the big reset button on to say, okay, from an overarching perspective, if we fix, privacy, if we have the right connectors in terms of identifiers for consumers, so that we can respect privacy preferences, so that we can reliably reach so that advertisers and others can reliably reach the consumers in that privacy compliant world, right? If we can have that identifier access for the same measurement and attribution we were just talking about, all controlled in a different way than it ever has been, and all yes, self serving here on behalf of Tech Lab, but all in a more standardized way, right? I think with the rules of the road pretty clear, we can get to a better place. And if we don't attack it that way, and it is literally, I called it use case by use case, but whatever you want to
piecemeal,
that you're addressing attribution and measurement. Well, okay, next let's address fraud and various forms of fraud, and next let's address targeting and various forms of, and then personalization and blah blah blah. All that list is, to your point, is extremely long. And we don't have we don't have the right to keep doing everything the way we've always done it because we've always done it that way. We really should learn from what's worked and what hasn't. And we should learn from what governments are literally telling us at this point. But yeah, I think it can't be a good thing to have to rebuild every single piece and to do it in a way that's undoubtedly going to be different from platform to platform, even if, you know, there's some level of you know, participation through W3C or otherwise to try to create some new standards.
Yeah.
You know, there's a limit to that too, right? Yeah. We can't rebuild all of it, I think, in any reasonable amount of time.
And I'm thinking, I mean, you know, you sort of gave a nod to, you know, to your involvement with IRB Tech Lab there, but it must make you sort of just internally eye roll a little bit, even just from a sort of, you know, technical expert's point of view, that every time one of these challenges comes along and someone that kind of controls a big part of the industry already goes, oh yeah, we've listened to what you said, so we've come up with this solution. It must still kind of make you sigh a little bit and just think, oh yeah, but that's only going to do this. It's not necessarily going to fix that. And like you said, it's too much of a bottom-up approach.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, I think that's exactly right. And yes, it causes a little bit of an eye roll, but I mean, I am super, you know, self-critical on behalf of our industry of where we are and how we got here.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we have to listen, we have to understand that there are different voices at the table now than there ever have been. But yeah, it's pretty easy to look at this kind of announcement from Apple and say, yes, this solves one problem, sort of. How would it connect to solving any of those other problems in any kind of remotely, you know, logical, seamless way? I guarantee they haven't thought through all of that. That's not their role exactly,
no.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the piecemeal is a very good way to describe it, right? The piecemeal, as you said, right? The piecemeal approach is basically just going to cause us to have to rebuild piece by piece, yeah. Right? Over a pretty long period, and we're going to get other things wrong, right? And so why, you know, what can we do in a sort of more broad stroke kind of way, right? To fix the core problems rather than just, oh, yeah, let's fix that little, let's put a little paint over there. Let's, you know, tuck that under the rug. Let's do, that's not going to work very well, I would argue.
I think broad stroke is a really good way of putting it, because actually they're still, arguably, you're only really addressing half the problem, and they're still able to do what they like with your data. They're still a walled garden with a lot of data. I went into my app store. I have an Apple, a Fisher-Price phone, as Kieran would call it. I went into my app store and slapped
down
on...
Don't listen to him, Lindsay. What does he know?
That's great. Absolutely right. Couldn't agree more. Big homepage takeover saying, you're going to be in Madrid. Download all these apps to help you around Madrid.
Yeah.
I was like, excuse me, how did you... Are you telling the third party apps I've downloaded that are you taking the data from them and then using that to target me? Or is this native apps I'm using? I'm not sure, because I don't really use many native apps that would know I'm in Madrid. So it must be third party apps. So they're doing something that they shouldn't be doing. But then from their perspective, the App Store, I mean, you talked earlier, Dennis, about device IDs and kind of what the next stage of that is and what it looks like from an iOS perspective. I just find that quite interesting, because it's a little bit contradictory. Yeah, I'm largely cynical, as we all know, but it's one rule for one side of the industry and one rule for the other side of the industry. And we do have to address the app problem, address kind of what the future of app targeting looks like, because arguably that's as big as a problem as targeting and privacy and personalization on browsers too.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
Yeah, and I think so that's the next stage. But obviously, again, me being cynical, Apple take 30% revenue of any purchase made from apps in their app store. So they're going to address that in a very, very different way versus the revenue, and I'm using air quotes here, that they get from the Safari browser.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah. Well, but it's interesting. And to your point, Dennis, yes, it's not necessarily their role to look at fixing everything in the industry, but then, you know, connecting to what Lindsay's just said, they perhaps have a vested interest in not performing that role. But then if we're kind of moving already into territory that we'll launch into the second part of the podcast. But I mean, that is the role of industry bodies like the IRB, like Tech Labs. That is the point, right? It's to try to develop these industry standards and industry-wide approaches. To what extent do you ever feel involved in any of the stuff that you know, Apple are working on at the moment?
Very, very little with Apple.
Right? I thought you might say that.
You know, we've had, you know, some engagement with Apple, but very limited. That's unfortunate in my mind. You know, we are not. You know, to your point, I mean, it's, yes, we have a sort of self-proclaimed role, right, in a way to help create these technical standards, but we don't do so in a vacuum, right? We have 1,000 member companies that are participating, you know, increasingly more companies outside of the US too. And it's, you know, the whole point here is to bring the right people to the table to decide, you know, what can work better, right? What can allow us to work more effectively together? What can allow us to abide by, you know, laws and get ahead of, you know, get ahead of the law to a degree and make it, you know, make this an even better industry than we're legally required to.
Yes, not wait to be slapped on the wrist constantly infringing on people's user experience or rights or privacy or what have you.
And so, you know, it has been... You know, it's been a little bit of a thorn in my side, frankly, right, that Apple has not been more at the table, because I really think we could have some very constructive conversations. You know, we definitely interact more, you know, with the other browser makers.
Yep.
Who are
key members of the IAB as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, but they will decide what they want to decide, right, to be clear. And the browsers are absolutely distinct from the advertising businesses of the companies that they're associated with, right? And so that's an interesting dynamic. I actually lived through that a little bit when I was at Microsoft and, you know, had at that point, the rather dominant browser, right, Internet Explorer, make a decision about Do Not Track.
Internet Explorer.
Right? And, you know, declared, we're going to do Not Track, right? Yeah. And we're going to set it on by default. And you know, they had not talked to anybody in the advertising group, right? And that's actually, to a degree, that separation of church and state, if you will, good thing, right? To a large degree, a little bit of education and back and forth, probably a better thing. But, you know, but yeah, it's absolutely important, I think, that you know, that each of these companies has, you know, has different lines of business, and they're going to act accordingly. But yeah, I think there's an opportunity to come to the table together as much as we can, even though these are competing companies, right?
Yeah.
And figure out, you know, how can we really do this better?
Yeah. Bit of a semi segue into story number three.
Just a semi segue.
Yeah, because it's a little bit related, but not. Very clear lines of thought here this afternoon. And the third news story, less of a story and more of a piece of reflection, really, which is that it's the 1 year anniversary of the implementation of GDPR.
Happy anniversary.
Yes, exactly. Happy anniversary, GDPR. You're 1 year old.
Clink the microphone.
We're drinking Cerveza for you. Beer to everybody else in the world. And in fact, it came up in discussions on stage here today, much discussion about what everybody was busy doing this time last year. We wrote an article this week in Exchange Wire about what's happened in that intervening year and a little bit of a synopsis of where we think, you know, GDPR could head or some things that we think ought to happen from here onwards. And I suppose some of the things that we touched on were that actually breaches to the legislation are not really widely reported. There is some, or reporting of them is sort of varies quite dramatically from European region to European region within the EU, that there hasn't actually been, pardon me, that much of an implementation of fines across the board. They haven't been, there's been obviously some fairly sort of, you know, significant press around some big fines, but there haven't actually been that many fines brought forward. That we know data protection authorities are completely overwhelmed and not really in a position where they're able to enact many of the things that they would like to or enforce the full force of the legislation. And that, you know, that's probably had the effect of there being a little bit of a malaise of disinterest around GDPR to one extent. Then on the other hand, at the same time, bear with us, listeners, there might be a little bit of background noise here. We've got some technical bump out going on. This is what happens when you record a podcast.
They may remove us in about 5 minutes.
Might, we might be taken off.
We'll pick up what we left off somewhere else.
Exactly. Yeah. Might have to retreat to the roof terrace, to the hotel roof terrace after all. So what I would like to know from the two of you is your reflections on what you think GDPR has achieved in the last 12 months. Or what I was going to say associated with all of that was that at the same time, this conversation around data privacy and user experience, which was inspired by the implementation of GDPR, has heated up, particularly in regions like the US, where you're looking mm-hmm. at the California legislation and various other conversations around government regulations. So I would say that from the perspective of ExchangeWire, taking into account the research that we did for this article and just our general opinions in chit-chatting about the industry and learning how it's unfolding in different European regions, it's certainly been an important feature of our lives in the last 12 months. But what has the legislation actually achieved? Fairly little. It's had a fairly minimal impact. But I'm interested to know what you guys think. Obviously, there's the IAB Europe consent framework, which is a really good piece of work that's effectively, in our view, attempting to implement some of the things that GDPR kind of gets to the heart of, but in a different, more usable context. Dennis, even though you don't reside in Europe, let's hear your perspective on GDPR 1 year old.
Yeah, no, I think a couple of thoughts. One is, no, I don't reside in Europe, but it's perhaps the most important thing that Tech Lab is doing relative to Europe, right, is partnering with IAB Europe to actually govern, manage, right, the technical aspects of that transparency and consent framework,
yep.
Which has just been terrifically educational for us, right, to figure out, the ins and outs of who the different parties are that need to weigh in and learn a whole lot more, right, about GDPR. And I would say it's pretty amazing how much we've all had to learn together and interpret and reinterpret and understand as there have been some new signals coming from different DPAs during the course of the year. I think we all have a better sense now of what this GDPR thing really is, right?
Yeah.
And I think actually from a US perspective, I would disagree with what you said that it's had little impact, that GDPR has had little impact, because in many ways it's the precursor to privacy everywhere else,
yes,
right?
That is a good point.
And not
point,
even
actually.
Just the US, but Brazil and Canada and elsewhere, right?
Absolutely.
And it's pretty amazing.
I think what I was saying, sorry to interrupt, but I think what I was thinking when I was saying that was related to a conversation on stage here today, which is I think this time last year everybody thought the world was going to end and that something really bad was going to happen a couple of days after GDPR.
I'd say Armageddon.
It was,
Oh, yeah.
Apparently.
And
that
hasn't been realised. But arguably some much better things have been realised, which is, like you say, the start of a much broader, more helpful, more applicable and useful conversation around what should happen.
Agree. Yeah, I agree on all of that. And I think what we still haven't figured out is how to engage the consumer in a meaningful way, right?
Yeah,
good point. And that was actually an aspect of the framework, of the transparency and consent framework, that was intentionally kind of left to the side, in part because a number of different parties wanted to interpret, the way they wanted to interpret.
Interesting.
Right. But also it's important. Right. So this is an important opportunity in many ways to learn what works, what doesn't work with consumers. And by the way, when I say that, I do not mean what tricks a consumer into clicking OK. I mean, like, really, this is the first time in many ways that we've had an enforced mechanism to engage with consumers about their privacy, to educate them to a degree about what we do and don't do as an industry, right? It's long been this, consumers don't care. They don't really want to learn the details. They don't want to understand what we do. And there's nothing that forced them to. That the interest managers that Facebook and Google and many others have offered over the years just have a trickle of users visiting. People have not engaged. Right, to really manage their interests, their privacy settings. So in many ways, that's sort of the biggest benefit, if you will, of GDPR, is it means the consumer has to pay attention, and it means we all then have to pay attention to how we educate and engage with the consumer. And thinking about that in a US context, as it differs from GDPR in Europe, is also fascinating, right? I certainly hope we do not wind up with, currently 17, at least 17 states in the US are considering different privacy legislation. And of course, California has passed it and it starts in 6 months, effective 7 months, right? January 1st. Washington state has approved through the Senate, and it's, it's a scary thought to think about having to, again, from the consumer perspective, having to educate a consumer. If I'm literally, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to Tahoe in California, but Tahoe as a town, right, South Lake Tahoe, crosses the line.
Tahoe,
yes, exactly.
Right,
yeah. Sorry, crosses, you know, the California Nevada border, and I, you know, I like to joke. Well, okay, so I'd get a different, you know, dialogue box or notice if I stepped into California than if I were on the Nevada side. That's just ludicrous, right?
Yeah,
and
completely.
And from a consumer perspective, that's not helpful.
No. Well, right? And you would think it would just really accelerate consumers into a world where they really stop caring, because
exactly.
How on earth would you navigate your way around all of that?
That's exactly
right. You would just feel constantly frustrated and think, yep, whatever, I just want to get to the content.
That's right. And then, so I think, you know, there's an opportunity here. Ideally on a more global basis, you know, we can cross
our
fingers.
That would be great, wouldn't
right?
it? World peace, so,
yeah,
unified privacy laws.
Led by data, everything's
exactly,
data.
Exactly, exactly. But yeah, it would be ideal for this to be more similar than different on a global basis.
Yeah.
Because so many consumers move around, right?
Yeah.
And I think we want to get to a point where there are best practices that are well understood in how you engage the consumer in a meaningful way, right? To obtain their consent where you need to, or educate them. You know, if you don't need their consent, you may still need to educate them about what you've chosen to do with legitimate interest, for example, right, with GDPR.
And just a word on how is that unfolding from your perspective in the US then, where you've got 17 different states looking at 17 slightly different pieces of legislation? Are you lobbying at a federal level to try to get federal laws in place? I know there's been discussions from a federal level. What do you think what would be the desired outcome in that situation?
So it has definitely, you know, spurred many to action in the US, that, you know, having 17 states considering independent legislation. The IAB, so IAB US, separate from Tech Lab, yep. but has a pretty strong, you know, public policy arm, and you know, ANA and 4As and other associations in the US have absolutely been banding together, you know, to a degree here to get in front of you know, the Senate, the House of Representatives in the US, appropriate staffers, et cetera, to, you know, to encourage federal legislation on privacy. And you know, the challenge there is, you know, the California legislation, I don't know if you know the history of how it came to be. Do you know the
it's
history?
A great story.
It's a great story. I'll keep it short, but it's, and you can edit out later as you
no,
see.
No, do entertain us.
So there is, you know, a wealthy real estate mogul in California who basically decided that, you know, consumer privacy and digital and beyond, by the way, this isn't only about digital, was a very important thing, right? And California, despite its enormous scale and, you know, 50 million residents and all the craziness of California being the fifth largest economy in the world if it were a country, mm-hmm. things like that, has a very simple way to get something on the ballot. I believe you need 300,000 signatures, which in a state that large turns out is not
easy
very hard
peasy,
to do,
yeah.
right? So he managed to get this, you know, lined up to be on the ballot last year. And, you know, thankfully, in a way, the legislature saw this coming, knew that what was going on the ballot was quite flawed, right, and overly simplistic and very detrimental to the economy in many ways, and took a pass at, you know, how quickly could they move something through the legislature, and in about, you know, just over a week, basically, put together legislation. So you can imagine it's not the most, you know, dot the I, cross the T kind of piece of work ever.
Work, yeah.
So it has some problems, right? And that's, you know, so the IAB public policy team has also been in Sacramento, California, the capital, you know, trying to encourage amendments to the California law. But the real trick here then becomes, how do you align a, you know, a federal law with California, which has set a really, really strict, you know, starting point at least, and we don't want to be, you know, perceived or really, you know, watering down, right, if you will. That's the quick, you know, reaction to it in many cases is, oh, you're just looking for federal privacy because you want something, you know, weaker than California. That's not really the goal. I mean, the goal is to improve upon what California did in many ways. But also, you know, to create something that is just you know, much more consumer friendly when you get right down to it. Simpler, you know, actually, if you think about the Microsoft Edge browser announcement, yes, not quite the scale of Internet Explorer at this point, but in its heyday, but their announcement was pretty interesting the same day that Chrome had its announcement. You know, they are pretty clearly focused on not providing too much, you know, detail to the consumer. And I mean that in a good way, right? They want to keep the settings clear, but pretty simple, right? That you can have very strict settings for privacy, or you can have kind of unrestricted, or you can use balanced, which is the middle setting, right? Yeah. And you know, I think that basic notion is kind of a good thing from a consumer's perspective, right? That they want some, a consumer wants some level of control, but do they need to understand every little detail all the time? Ideally not, right? And so how do we get to a place where the privacy law, at least in the US, where we have the opportunity to learn from GDPR in particular, yeah. You know, is drafted such that, you know, it's pretty clear that there are certain uses of data that are just always off limits. And then it's clear that there is a set that is up to the consumer, right? And that's kind of the direction that you can look up privacyforamerica.com, actually. That's the work that IAB and others are doing to, you know, to create something that that hopefully is, you know, very consumer friendly and that could help pave the way for, you know, for federal legislation in the US.
Yeah. Lindsay, what's your view on the 1 year anniversary of GDPR? Reflections.
I don't know how I can follow everything Dennis just said because it was very, very informative.
I'm sorry.
No, please don't apologise. I was just listening to you.
No, I mean, I have several other sub questions, but I just thought, hang on,
there's some good stuff here.
Yeah, don't go down a US legislation rabbit hole. Yeah, bring
exactly.
it back. Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking. I've now got questions about, I know, US legislation.
Exactly. It's fascinating.
It's just crazy. But I think, yeah, GDPR, obviously, it was necessary, or a form of it was necessary. And I think that's certainly been proven. A year on, that's been proven. A year on, I think the best is yet to come, whether you look at that as the best or the worst, but it's yet to come. But I also think it's iterative and it's evolving. And, you know, we talked earlier about the TCF, and, you know, we're now in version, about to be in version two of that. And that, again, is an evolving process. No one ever thought it would be the perfect framework when it was first launched. Well, people did think that, but they shouldn't have thought that, because actually we need to learn from what's happening and learn from our mistakes. I think that applies to all of GDPR. It's not a law, so it's being interpreted by everybody very, very differently. It's being interpreted by DPAs across Europe very, very differently. It's being interpreted and understood by countries outside of Europe that are trying to do something similar very, very differently. Like the DPAA, that legislation, they've looked at GDPR to a certain degree and gone, don't like that, but I do like that. Yeah. Let's reword that and let's put that stink on it instead. So I think there's lots that can be done for it. And I think that, you know, the fact that it's European-wide legislation makes a lot of sense. And I think the US needs to listen to that, because that's mental. That is actually mental.
Well, yeah, because it's not just about user experience, although that is the, you know, the principal point. But how do they implement a piece of legislation on an individual basis? Yeah, exactly.
As the tech standards guy, I look at that and my
head
explodes.
Heart failure.
Right? Yeah, no, it's a problem.
Want to go and sit in a darkened room?
If you have any relationship with a consumer on a national level, how would you even begin to be able to communicate with your consumers in every different state they live in?
Well,
right,
exactly.
And the risk that you would incur, right? And the way California is drafted, if you have, you know, if you're
and
above
25... And you are a litigious nation, so they'll be suing all over the show.
This is true. And then, you know, in California, I believe the law says that, you know, if you have 25,000 consumers that you interact with, so users of a website, for example, that you are subject to the law. So if you have one of those consumers who actually is a California resident, or is that, you have a problem, right? Suddenly, to your point, you have to be paying close attention. And that's mental, as you said.
We thought it was mind-boggling enough when we were thinking about the implementation of GDPR last year, and sort of, you know, going, well, hang on a minute. So even if you're a global business, but you've got European customers, that's going to affect you too, you know. And of course, it was all sort of, you know, exciting drama a couple of days after the legislation sort of unfolded and people in Europe could no longer access the LA Times.
The US publishers, yeah.
exactly.
Right. Like, right.
What? Yeah. I can't imagine.
How dare
that.
They?
It's very real.
Yeah. Yeah, but anyway, Lindsay, sorry, I think I sidetracked you there.
Oh, no, it's fine. I can't remember what I was saying now. No, but I think the GDPR, something like it has needed to happen. It's still iterative. I feel like from a consumer perspective, they still don't really understand what they're getting into. Because I think, Dennis, your point about actually having a sort of muted levels of control, it's the age-old adage of, you know, I buy the car, I don't need to know every single thing about
I
just need to know what how it works for me to be able to use it. I need to know how it works for me to be able to be safe and secure and not have a car crash, basically. Mm. And a similar sort of thing. How do I keep myself safe from fraud, from whatever else, without having to understand every single little thing about how it was all put together and what you're taking of my data and why and how you're using it. So I think those kind of controls are probably quite a good idea. But I feel like a lot of consumers still believe that GDPR means they will not see ads. Actually, it just means they'll see less relevant ads. And that's something that I think they're starting to see now, we're starting to understand now. And I think we'll get there. But everyone also thought that people would try and bring everyone else down. So big competing companies are trying to bring other companies down by reporting them.
Putting forward a complaint.
That's
and that
not
hasn't happened.
No. So I think everyone's taking it more seriously, I think, than maybe everyone's being more adult about it than they probably thought they would.
Well, because I think it did sort of then start this train in motion, as you mentioned earlier on, Dennis, which was just the beginning of a much more serious conversation globally, which is actually this stuff is really important. If we put the user first, this is really important. And this is at the heart of what we're trying to achieve if we think about user experience.
Yep.
And so I think that's why, Lindsay, but you're quite right. You know, we had all sorts of conspiracy theories, being fleshed out.
Everyone loves drama.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And there remains, I think, a huge question about how you maintain a robust ecosystem of content and services for consumers. You know, from innovative small companies in particular, right? In the face of a lot of this different, you know, legislation and regulation. Because in many cases, you run the risk that you benefit the strong first parties, right? And those who have, you know, those for whom almost any consumer, any user of their site or app or what have you, would say, yeah, I'm okay, right? You can use my data because I place so much value on the service that you provide to me, and that's a real challenge if you're a small website, small retailer, small whatever, right? And it's, you know, I think we would all hate to have, you know, all of this protection of consumers be used in a way that it actually stifles innovation and stifles what's available and a richness of content and services for all of us.
Absolutely. And I think that is connected to what you mentioned earlier on as well, Dennis, and that links into what Lindsay was just saying too, is that we need to get a little bit better at articulating the value of the content that we're providing and the ads that are, you know, that go alongside that content, because and the value exchange that we're expecting or that we're wanting to enter into rather with the user and the consumer, because I just think that's just still unbelievably not well enough articulated. I say unbelievably, not in a sense to blame anyone, but it's almost as though we've tied ourselves up in knots trying to unpick everything. We've forgotten to sort of explain in very simple terms why people ought to consume advertising at all in the first instance and how that could be better.
Right.
And why it's important to make a thoughtful decision about that when you're controlling use of your data and controlling how you navigate around your browser.
Which in part, I think, comes back to, you know, this being a moment where we can actually engage with consumers and educate, hopefully, right, if we do this well, right, in a way that we've never been able to before.
Yeah.
Right.
We've never had that platform before.
We haven't. Right? And now it's forced on the consumers that we have a platform. It's an interesting concept, right?
You're quite right. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think we can't waste that opportunity, basically.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. And that is definitely a good segue into second part of the podcast, which was to have a bit more of a chat, Dennis, with you about what you're up to at IAB Tech Lab. I feel like that list is very, very long. And
it is.
Feel like there's so many things that we could talk about.
It's all about the standards.
That's it. It's all about the standards. And I also feel as though, you know, we have the pleasure of having you at some of our ATS events and presenting some really, really interesting stuff to the audience that I know many people are really interested in and really engaged by. And we never quite get enough time to really go into it. So pick a topic, any topic. Tell us what you'd like. And I will remind you that you mentioned you mentioned in our pre-chat that you were keen on saying something about display video, but Over to you.
Yeah, no, there's so much. You know, I think, you know, I touched on the sort of theme areas in the session today that we've come to focus on, and we've evolved that. We've actually sort of realized as Tech Lab that one of the hardest challenges we have is to convey, it's actually to your point about value exchange in a way, to convey the value of what we do. Like, why should anyone care about what Tech Lab does? And it's, you know, we've drawn some parallels to standards that, you know, technical standards that all of us as consumers rely on every day, like Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and USB, where actually to your point, Lindsay, about, you know, the car, right? Let's, you don't need to know everything about how the car works, right? You don't need to know, I don't think any of us know everything about how Wi-Fi works, right? Or Bluetooth.
I definitely don't. Disclaimer.
But they do, right? And they enable you to, you know, Wi-Fi enables you to walk in anywhere and connect, right? And that's kind of magical in a way, except that it's actually not, right? There's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes.
Oh, so disappointing.
Yeah, no. And there's a standards body that looks after that, right? And has different versions of, you know, 802.11, right? Which is the standard for Wi-Fi. And
this is so geeky.
Isn't it great?
I know. I really like it. I love that you could just recite that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what Tech Lab does for digital advertising, right? Is we create standards that, no, mostly you don't really need to know exactly all the details of how they work, but understanding why they're valuable, right? And where you should care about them, when you should care about them is important. So we, you know, we think about our standards now in terms of, you know, which group of the standards are useful for brand safety and ad fraud, which are useful for identity data and consumer privacy, which are useful for ad experiences and measurement, and which are useful for programmatic efficiency and transparency. And these are hopefully terms that most anyone in the industry would hear and go, yeah, okay, I'm familiar with that.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. It sounds like a pretty sensible list to me.
We're trying. Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, so in each of those areas, you know, we have anywhere from, you know, 5 to probably 15 different standards that kind of bucket in. And, you know, I would say very much consistent with the conversation we had in part one here, standing out right now at kind of the top of the list is identity and privacy, you know, and what we're doing with the transparency and consent framework with IAB Europe for privacy, how that might be extended actually to support other countries and states and such, right? That's an interesting question. We have the DigiTrust, you know, ID service basically, right? To enable ID matches in a much more simple way. But that's based on cookies, right? And that's challenged now. So figuring out the evolution there of how we can provide, you know, what service we should be providing going forward to support, you know, more effective and privacy compliant, of course, use of IDs throughout the industry.
Yeah.
Really, really critical. We have more on the brand safety and ad fraud side. You know, ads.txt, we're very proud of our baby there.
Yes. Right?
A lot of awareness of ads.txt in a pretty short period of time, actually.
And its iterative cousin.
App ads.txt, yep. Exactly. Yes. So yeah, app ads.txt for mobile and app, or actually it can work for OTT in app, right? So it's really just the app version of ads.txt.
Okay.
And for those who don't know ads.txt, it's an acronym, of course. It's authorized digital sellers. So it's, you know, the publisher saying, these are the sellers that I work with. That I'm aware of, right? Where you should be able to find my inventory. And if you don't, if you're working with somebody and you find my inventory and they're not on that list, probably you shouldn't be working with them, right?
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that ads.txt family in a way was kind of the key starting point. But we've now have in public comment a couple of different specs that go hand in hand. One is sellers.json, speaking of geeky.
Yep. You will be pleased to know, Dennis, we have actually discussed that in in a Mad Tech podcast.
We do love sellers.json. It's awesome.
Yeah. It's no, and it's a, yeah, it's a good tool, right? It's in some ways it's the ads.txt for exchanges and SSPs, right?
Yep.
And then the supply chain object, which actually allows, you know, allows the transaction, all the sellers that touch a transaction to be recorded. Right. And that's probably useful for obvious reasons, right? To then map back to, were they authorized sellers? Were they, you know, if through ads.txt, were they listed by the exchange or SSP that I know about as a buyer or a DSP, right? So there's a lot of interesting sort of self-checking and policing that has to happen throughout the use of these standards. And that's, that kind of brings up this core point of everybody kind of taking a piece of responsibility there to make sure that, each party in the chain is doing the right thing, and that in no case should we always just kind of point the finger at somebody else and say, oh, that's their problem, right? Everybody has a role to play here.
Yeah, we should be taking some collective responsibility.
Exactly. And that's kind of a new concept, surprisingly, to a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
And
in this industry, it is. Yes.
And it's an interesting, I think it's an interesting, result of some of these more recent standards, actually, that is, that they are very collaborative in a way, right? That a buyer needs to know to look for ads.txt and needs to know how to read it and all of that, for example. And so I think there's, we're starting to see kind of more naturally in a way, this sort of working across, right? From advertiser to publisher and agency and such, everybody in between, right?
And from your perspective, do you feel like that sort of, sense of collective responsibility? I suppose two questions here. Do you feel as though it's growing? I think you're going to say yes, maybe even tentatively. And does it vary from region to region, from country to country? Because obviously you're...
That's a great question.
Yeah, looking to...
It's, I doubt, yes, I would say yes, as you said. I mean, it does feel like there's been a little more, there's a lot more leaning in from some parties. We're still not where I would want to be on the buy side in particular. Mm-hmm. Agencies lean in more, brands in many cases, I think, just don't, right? It's somebody else's problem. That's what I pay you for.
They don't necessarily feel that bonded to it, I suppose. They either don't feel responsible, or perhaps they feel distracted by other priorities, or perhaps they feel it's in the hands of their agency.
And they've had, and they've long had KPIs that are actually quite counter to solving some of the problems that we're trying to solve, like fraud, for example, right? Yeah. If you set KPIs as volume of impressions and CPMs and things like that, guess what's going to happen, right?
And they still exist many places across the industry, those KPIs.
Sure, despite, absolutely.
Thank you, procurement teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly.
That's a whole other podcast, isn't it?
It really is. Someone from procurement. I would love to have one just on procurement.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, okay, I totally agree. And then, in terms of, regional differences and who's engaged more or less, I would, certainly the U.S., based, global ad tech companies are kind of at the core of Tech Lab. And I actually think that sort of makes logical sense, right? They are the connective tissue in many ways across the industry, right?
Yeah, it's where a lot of, companies fundamental to advertising technology started.
Exactly.
And it is still the most developed marketplace in that regard.
Right, exactly, exactly. That said, it's really, really important to have, more engagement to make sure that we're considering, European specific or, APAC specific considerations in what we develop and how it evolves, to have the right people at the table. And, nothing actually makes me more frustrated in this job than hearing, sort of behind the scenes, stab you in the back, finger pointing that, we don't like this thing that Tech Lab is doing. And, my answer is, well, join. Participate, lean in, be at the table, tell us what you need, right? Because that's
involved.
Our job, right? But guess what? It's, get involved. That is the responsibility of those parties, not again to point fingers, but to be at the table, and we would love to have them, right? And so we've made progress there, more so in Europe than in APAC, but there's a long way to go. And there are even tactical issues that we have to solve there, like working group times, right, for calls. I mean, I know that's like the most boring thing to consider, but we want to make this work. That's the point, right?
That's an area of sort of, practicality that becomes fundamentally important to any work that you're undertaking.
Exactly.
And I was just thinking as well, I suppose the thing about how these standards and initiatives might unfold in global marketplaces is that with things having stemmed from the US, I suppose in some regions you've got the advantage of having seen how it's played out in the US first, and so you might be able to catch things at a different rate, I suppose, or a different you know, point in industry development in other regions.
Yeah.
And that might either help you make some modifications to some of the standards and tools, or just even help that particular marketplace tackle things and deal with issues and challenges a little more efficiently. Have you come across that yet?
Yeah, I think for sure. I mean, I think the ads.txt was a good example again, not to overuse it, but the how rapidly that actually was adopted on a global basis was pretty remremarkable. And and it's and it's even and fraud rates vary tremendously from country to country and region to region, but the fact that it was sort of this wake up call to a global audience to say, oh, okay, here's something we can do that actually, as things go, is relatively simple, right? And can really help solve a huge problem. I think that was very well appreciated, I think, on a global basis. And it was born in the US, right? But it's not, there's nothing really about anything we build that's ever designed to be, US specific. In fact, the only thing we've done that's region specific at all is the transparency and consent framework. Isn't that ironic?
Here in Europe, yeah.
I was about to ask that question. I was going to say, obviously, IAB Europe TCF is a great example. Like, how often do you do regional projects with regional IABs?
That's the first one, right? And I'm so glad that we partnered there. And as I said, we've learned so much. And there may well be other cases where it makes sense to engage in similar projects. I mean, obviously, from a sort of scalability perspective for our small team, et cetera, it's more efficient to come up with anything that can help on a global level, right? But to the degree that there are, I think there are two buckets. One is sort of regional differences or country level differences that should be incorporated into global standards, and then there are regional or country level standards. That absolutely we're interested in both areas.
Yeah.
But we can't do any of it without the right engagement.
Yeah. And did you want to not to sort of detract from what we've just been talking about, but did you want to say anything about digital video? Just because
The death of VPaid.
Yes, for example. Yes.
Go on. Right. Go ahead.
Thank you for that. I touched on a couple of key things we're doing in brand safety and ad fraud, a couple in identity data and consumer privacy. Although actually I neglected to mention the data label, which is another thing under that data category that is kind of like the food nutrition label for data segments.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like the way it's been described.
And that one has been another one actually that's been surprisingly popular on a global level. Like APAC actually has expressed, various countries in APAC have expressed some interest. But on video, which kind of falls in the ad experiences and measurement bucket, right? The video, death of VPaid. Long rumored, long desired, right? By publishers in particular, right? We've released, right, CIMID, which is the secure interactive media interface definition. So not the easiest thing to remember.
Yep.
But that is kind of the replacement for VPaid. VPaid, the short version there of why people hate it is, why some people hate it, is that, it was originally intended for interactive additions to video ads. But because of the way it was designed, it was much more adaptable, let's just say. Right? and it started to be used to solve the problem of verification. Such as what an integral ad science or double verify or mode or what have you would do. Great. This is another case of the industry finding a way to solve a real problem, right? But on the downside, it meant just more, bloated, basically bloating the video experience and actually introducing, more tracking that would be unknown or malware even in some cases. It's just not good. Mm. So CIMID is 100% focused on interactive video. And it actually pairs with VAST 4.2, which is the video ad serving template. So that template includes a pointer to to an interactive file or to a video file. It includes a link to, if you will, to open measurement, which is the other piece here of that stool. Other leg of that stool is that we needed a solution to solve that, to address that verification problem, right? Yep. That so that VPAID or CIMID or whatever, you know, came next didn't have to be overloaded on a, yep, you know, continuing basis.
Yeah.
So the notion there is that open measurement enables capturing viewability signals from mobile apps, and actually also provides an interface definition for website-based viewability. It does other things too, but that's kind of where it started. And it's having that combination of VAST as a modern template, if you will, CIMID as the kind of core mechanism for interactive video, and the open measurement interface definition for, you know, verification, broadly speaking, allows us to move away from VPAID. So not the simplest thing, but what's really good about it is that we now have very clear, focused standards in each of those areas, and video, I think, as a result, is in video advertising is a much better place.
Shape. Yeah, yeah.
As and, a result. And will help across OTT and all, as all of this evolves, and even as, you know, linear TV increasingly becomes addressable and digital, right? You know, all of this is helpful, right? Yep. To kind of create a soft landing, if you will, and a connection point.
Yep. Great. Dennis, unbelievably, we've run out of time. We could keep talking to you about IOV Tech Lab and standards pretty much all day, but we're going to be chucked out of the building.
We're being chucked out. Yeah. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Well, let me just say OpenRTB 3.0, which is the one thing I would call out in that last bucket of programmatic efficiency and transparency, and say thank you.
No, thank you.
Most definitely. It's been a pleasure, Dennis and Lindsay. And that was this week's MedTech Podcast. Podcasts.